Hi, if you're watching these videos in sequence, stick around at the end for a quick message that will explain some things before you get to the next video. This is History of Industrial Design, week something, the Art Nouveau. Last time you saw me, this is where we were, the Crystal Palace Exposition of 1851, with this kind of object. We also looked at some amazing technological advances that seemed pretty far away from that decorated Victorian clutter. And we saw one amazing design that transcended the limitations of the era's ability to combine industry with integrity. And we also saw the development of different sorts of aesthetic confidence. What we didn't find was a real coherent, clear logic. You were right to find it all confusing. Integrating new materials and new technologies with industry and any kind of agreement about aesthetics was difficult and messy, and so telling the story of it is invariably difficult and messy. I think you'll enjoy this week's content because it's the most focused and sort of preserved in amber for us to look at and talk about as a complete experience. The Art Nouveau period still suffered from faster advances than we could master and all sorts of chaos as a result. But there was also a newfound confidence in both conceiving of and then producing designed goods. These are the kind of objects that sort of visually summarize the Art Nouveau. If we were in class, students would be throwing out adjectives to describe this, and I have a backup list in case they don't have the energy to do that. My list of adjectives to describe these things includes sinuous, tensile, foliate, lavish, exotic, refined, dynamic, tendril-infested, molten, and my favorite descriptor of the Art Nouveau style of all of them, the octopus rococo. However you want to describe it, there's this remarkably unified aesthetic. All of the stuff made in this style looks like it fits together, and this happened around the world. It was a global exploration of this really unified visual aesthetic. It was completely self-conscious. It was in fact self-identified. This was a commercial design style called Art Nouveau when it was happening. All of the other styles that we've looked at or even will look at this semester were named later. The Art Deco style wasn't called Art Deco until the 1960s, and it happened in the 20s and 30s. We don't know what we're doing when we're doing it. It's just called being alive, doing stuff. And later we can look back and understand what we were thinking about. The Art Nouveau period is an exception. It was an effort to do something specific, and it was named in its day. As a style, it's really familiar to us, mostly graphically. We live in a world where the Art Nouveau graphics are still sort of everywhere. But it existed in all different materials and scales and formats and geographies around the world. Most style change is gradual, but the Art Nouveau had a relatively sudden appearance around 1884 and an almost instantaneous disappearance with World War I. The moment, as a result, is really fixed in time and a compressed amount of time, which is one of the reasons it's easy to identify and discuss. I added little red labels in the upper left-hand corner of every sort of chapter title because there's a lot of them, and I wanted to keep myself on track and honest. I want to introduce a couple of different chapters to get through talking about the Art Nouveau. And the first would just be, what is it? How would you identify it? How would you describe it? What are the visual characteristics of the Art Nouveau? Most things made in the Art Nouveau period have a sort of whiplash curve. It's a curve that starts out casual and relaxed and then gathers speed and intensity and coils in on itself, or the opposite. It uncoils slowly and then sort of relaxes outwards with a burst of energy. There's a kind of curve you see in most Art Nouveau work. There's also a lightness of form. There's carving for decorative effect, just like in the Victorian period. This wood has been carved to take these shapes. But it's not a surface activity, it's a formal activity. The Art Nouveau style existed in every possible scale, from a little drawer pull or a small piece of jewelry to a wall cabinet to a doorway to an entire building to an entire subway system. So we see a really rapid change with a sort of farewell to the Victorian or Gilded era boxiness, heaviness, massive slabs of wood with carved surfaces all over them. These are beds. They have a pretty simple mission statement: support my body while I'm dreaming. But these beds add other layers of information. Who I am because I like this bed, probably what I'm going to dream about influenced by this bed. And look what happens when the Art Nouveau style takes over the design brief called Hold Me Up While I'm Sleeping. We get a completely different aesthetic. Goodbye boxy heavy bed, hello organic shapes and curves. The bed on the left is wood, the bed on the right is actually cast iron with wood panels. Whatever the material, and in this case also the aesthetics, I think they're pretty different, but I think you can agree they're drifting really far away from what beds had been a moment before. And we start to see subtleties even in how decoration is applied to an object, how the form and the decoration are linked. So the Tiffany pitcher on the left has chrysanthemums all over it. It's been chased and engraved within an inch of its life to be encrusted with chrysanthemums. And the vase on the right doesn't seem to have been made at all. It looks like it's swirled out of the mists or out of the water and is offering us a place to put our lily of the valley. They're both the same material and the same techniques, but it seems like the entire conception of them is different. We start to see how nature mattered to everyone in a new way. Artists and designers were augmenting what had happened in the Victorian era. William Morris took nature plus geometry and made these remarkable wallpaper patterns. Art Nouveau wallpaper is still using nature and geometry, but suddenly the geometric repeat is gone, and the plant material seems to have attacked the wallpaper of its own accord. It has a kind of life force and energy that isn't part of Morris's work. Also, when a style arrives quickly, existing companies have to decide to embrace it or not. So we see a lot of companies that had been around in the Victorian period doing Victorian stuff jump on the Art Nouveau bandwagon and start doing a completely new type of thing. Arthur Silver's wallpaper patterns are a great example of that. These two patterns couldn't be more different. And yet they're made of the same modules or components. In the Art Nouveau period, we also see the aesthetic expressed in every detail of these whole interiors. The Victor Horta Mansion is a great example. Every surface, the floors, the stairs, the railings, the walls, the pillars, are all designed to fit together and communicate this new aesthetic. So that's what the style looked like. If you went out on the street and encountered it, you'd recognize it and say hello. We need to figure out why it happened. So that's my next chapter. Why did the Art Nouveau happen? Why was there this radical, global, complete, swift change in what people were thinking about? In addition to all of the second industrial revolution technologies that we looked at last week, there are a bunch of new things just to think about. So this is just a list of things that happened. No one of them should matter too much in our conversation, but that all of this happened within such a narrow window should help you understand that the world was changing quickly, and so of course art and design would as well. In 1900, Max Planck developed his quantum theory. In 1901, Marconi sent the first transatlantic wireless signal, so global communication was on the horizon. And by 1903, there was a network of telegraph cables that allowed us to send a telegraph around the world. So the world had a waistline or a belt on for the first time. We knew how big it was. Also in 1903, it was a big year. The first manned flights at Kitty Hawk, so flight is on the horizon. The first silent movies were distributed. Pierre and Marie Curie won the Nobel Prize for their work with radiation. And then in 1905, Einstein published his theory of relativity. That's a lot of stuff, a lot of new ideas, a lot of new technologies. So if the world is changing because of all that new technology, it's also changing because we are developing new ways to talk to each other. One would be the telegraph, of course, the telephones. But printing was advancing in ways that also allowed us to communicate better and faster. Here's a bunch more random dates for you. 1865, web offset printing was developed to print on both sides of the paper at once, doubling the speed of printing. In 1870, we started making paper out of wood pulp instead of cotton, so cheaper, faster paper. We also arrived at the ability to print with four-color lithography in repeat in production. In 1891, printing presses were able to print and fold 90,000 four-page papers in an hour. More newspapers, more information. More information, more communication. More communication, more advances. It's a cycle. We also figured out diazotype printing and developed the ability to print photographs on fabric. I don't know why I think that matters or is interesting. It just is. In 1892, we got the four-color rotary press. So we could print all four colors in one process on the paper instead of having to do each color separately and letting the ink dry in between. In 1904, offset lithography became common. And so what are you going to do if you've got cheap paper, the ability to print 90,000 newspapers, the ability to print on both sides of the paper, the ability to print in color? What will you do? The obvious outcome of that equation is Buster Brown, the first comic book. Printing allowed cheaper and better print catalogs. I showed you Wedgwood's catalog, but that was made with hand-engraved copper plates. Expensive, time-consuming. If you get an inexpensive catalog, you can make a bigger catalog. You can sell more stuff. And we saw the birth of the mega catalog. In 1894, the Sears and Roebuck catalog arrived, and it was over 500 pages full of new things you could purchase, consumable things. Most American homes had the Bible and the Sears and Roebuck catalog as the two things guaranteed to be sort of found in the home. This brought commerce into rural places in a way it had not been before. New printing techniques also affected packaging. We developed the ability to put stuff in a metal container and put a label on that metal container, either a paper label or printing right on the metal. And that sounds like a small step forward. But imagine what it changed. The first printed metal boxes were made in 1866 to contain Dr. Lyon's tooth powder. At first, they had to hand solder every can. They made 60 cans a day. Once manufacturing took over and we were able to produce cans more affordably, we could put more and more products in that. Think what that's going to change. We start shipping and distributing food. Food becomes a commodity. That's going to change our relationship with commerce and consumption also. For a long time, we would buy stuff from people we knew, the farmer, the grocer, and we trusted them to sell us good quality things. And if they didn't, we could go back and complain. If I'm going to be buying Postum or Kellogg's Corn Flakes or something else that comes in a box or a can, I have to develop brand loyalty. I'm trusting that brand to sell me something good instead of my local grocer. And the new guarantee of quality became the logo and the character stamped on the package and the corporate name, my brand loyalty. Rapid printing also allowed including pictures with text, which was possible before. It had been possible since the very first printed anything, but in a larger, more mechanized, more accurate, more realistic way, we could combine text and images in huge volumes. So we got magazines. We saw that arrive rapidly and develop rapidly, and aesthetically it changed just as quickly. So look at these magazine covers from the 1870s and 1880s, and look how radically they're going to change in just 10 years because of all the new ability to print differently. This is one of the big reasons I think the Art Nouveau style could take over so quickly, because printed material allowed this new aesthetic to get places it couldn't have gotten otherwise. From 1890 on, magazines like Harper's and Lippincott's printed pull-out posters in the Art Nouveau style to sell magazines like a premium. This was sophisticated art for the new middle class. You might not be able to afford to shop at Tiffany's, but you could certainly afford to decorate your home with inexpensive printed material. The second reason the Art Nouveau style was able to take over so completely, so quickly, had to do with the continuation and the increase of global expos. This is Paris 1900. The shows had ushered in the beginnings of this global audience for design that continued and increased and scaled up, and the impact of them did as well. So ideas and styles and techniques were spread. The 1900 Paris Expo was the sort of super spreader of design innovation. Some things on view at the 1900 Expo. The Ferris wheel debuted there. It was 350 feet high. It held 1,600 passengers at once. That's a really big communal experience. Movies were projected to 25,000 people at a time. That's the biggest audience of people doing one thing at once that entertainment had seen at that point. And electricity was being explored as more than just a way to create artificial light or power a motor. Normally, when class happens live in person, during the break, I quietly walk out of the room and leave Loie Fuller on the screen to astound and mystify and confuse everyone. I can't let this moment pass and cut this slide out. So I need to talk about Loie Fuller. She was super important to the Art Nouveau style, but I also think she's just really interesting. Loie Fuller was an American. She was born in Illinois. She lived in Brooklyn. She wasn't particularly adept at dancing. She wasn't particularly attractive. She wasn't particularly anything. And yet she became the world's most famous person. Beyoncé-level fame, 1900. Essentially, she held wooden sticks in her hand that were attached to a lot of fabric, a big dress, and she twirled around. That's enough. She became the muse for Art Nouveau designers and artists who were trying to capture the spirit of the time and saw her as the living embodiment of it. So there's an endless number of photographs and posters and even movies of her. The reason I think she deserves the fame that she arrived at is that she actually was a brilliant inventor. She patented many innovations that would change her performance to make it more enticing and exciting. In the Lumiere Brothers film at the top, you see her changing color, and that's happening because they hand-painted every cell of that black and white film. But what they were trying to do was replicate what her stage show looked like, because she developed ways to use electricity, which was still very new at the time, to change her color while she danced. She had rotating gels, she had lights that projected from below, so part of her performance was just spinning around, but the majority of it was the effects that happened projected onto her while she spun around, which is a hard thing to appreciate without seeing her live. The New York Public Library has a lovely online exhibit about her that's worth checking out if you're interested. What we saw by the 1900 exposition was countries were still vying for supremacy over each other or attention, but more so companies started to really compete for medals at the show, for notice, and ultimately for customers. So companies would manufacture some showstopper piece to get everyone's attention. These are two dressing tables made by Gorham and Company here in Providence, Rhode Island. One for the Paris Exposition in 1900, which now lives in Dallas, and one for the St. Louis Exposition in 1903, which lives here in Providence at our own museum. They were meant to stop traffic. And while people were stopping at the Gorham booth, they would end up buying some lesser, smaller pieces. In today's world, we call it a loss leader, something you know you won't make money on, but it's going to generate lots of profit in other ways. If you happen to be in Providence, this desk is really worth scrutinizing up close. If you walk past quickly, it's just a chaos of surfaces and stuff. But if you stop and appreciate it, it's got ivory, ebony, walnut, silver, crystal, leather. It's a really remarkable tour de force of craftsmanship, but it's also really rewarding to look at and discover all the tiny little details. There's owls, there are the four seasons, there are floral motifs. The 1900 Paris Exposition covered 277 acres of Paris. Huge, huge footprint. And the planners realized they were going to need to get people moving around faster to get them to see all of that. They installed electric sidewalks in Paris. There were three elevated platforms, so you go from stationary up to the moderate speed and then up to the upper speed, which went 6 miles an hour. They must have been astounding. This is a film that Thomas Edison made when he was there because he was so impressed by them. These were not the first moving walkways. The first moving walkways were installed at the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, but Paris 1900 installed them at a scale that was unimaginable before. The global shows would not have been possible without improvements in travel. And that gets me to reason number three for the takeover of the Art Nouveau style, sort of linked to number two, the expos, and that's transportation. At the time, under sail, it would have taken 2 months to get across the ocean. There was transatlantic steam travel as early as the 1820s, but it was very primitive. That started to change. In 1838, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, whom we looked at earlier with his tunnels and bridges, designed the Great Western, which was a huge ship that took only 15 days to cross the ocean. So we went from 2 months to 15 days in the first generation of large-scale steam travel. It was the first steamship designed for regular Atlantic crossings, and it was iron-strapped wood. It was a wooden hull with iron straps to strengthen it, and it was a paddle steamer, so side paddles. And it was 250 feet long. But then in 1843, Brunel introduced his second ship, the Great Britain. This was the first large iron steamship. The hull was iron. And it was the first big ship to use a screw propeller. And at the time, it was the largest ship afloat. It took 14 days to cross, so only 1 day faster, but also larger. Brunel's third ship is a kind of fascination. It was 700 feet long. I know, somebody out there is going to say, no, it was 692 feet long. This is an introductory class. I can skip over some of the details, okay? It was the largest ship in the world for decades, I think for 40 years. It had a double hull of iron, and it was steam-powered with a propeller and paddle wheels, so power for every possible condition. It could go 14 knots. I think it took 9 days to cross the ocean, but I can't substantiate that. It was imagined to hold 4,000 passengers. It never wound up carrying more than a few hundred and had a really rocky history of transit. It did not really work as a passenger ship for a bunch of reasons. It ended up relocating to America. It was converted in 1864 to lay telegraph cables and had a long active duty doing so. The Great Eastern laid over 7 transatlantic telegraph cables. So didn't work as a passenger ship, but still did a lot of work for us. I mention this because we develop a new focus on conquering travel for passengers and freight in the Victorian era, but really maturing in the Art Nouveau era. And a couple of things helped that along. One would be the building of the Suez Canal, called the Highway to India. This was a human-made sea-level waterway in Egypt that connected the Mediterranean and the Red Seas, and it allowed water travel between Europe and Asia without having to go all the way around Africa. I found out recently that the Statue of Liberty, that famous thing France gave America to celebrate our relationship and to celebrate liberty and to welcome people to the country, was first offered to the Suez Canal, but that didn't end up happening, so here it came. Anyway, that has nothing to do with this story. By 1870, screw propellers were in regular use. Also, steel started to get used in a new way. Steel had been around for a very long time, but manufactured in larger quantities starting in the 1850s. Steel is just iron that's been carbonized, purified with the addition of minerals. And it started to be made on a large scale from 1890 on. That started getting used in ships and scaling up ships, bigger ships. Bigger ships need bigger waterways, so suddenly the Suez Canal wasn't so big, dug by hand with shovels. When we built the Panama Canal, that really was a celebration of this new era of larger steel-hulled ships, and it's a much larger waterway. It allowed travel from one side of the Americas to the other without having to go all the way around South America. So just like the telegraph made a belt around the world, we now have water travel around the meridian without having to go south around entire continents. Think what that will do for travel and for commerce, getting goods and people places faster. This era of ocean liners spills into next week, but we have to put a little bit of it in here now. Those steam engines that had started the Industrial Revolution and made their way into boats gave way to much larger engines, turbines and electricity. Much more efficient motors, and that sped things up. Ships got bigger, but they also got faster. The Mauritania is a good example. Almost 800 feet long, it held just over 2,000 passengers, and it could cross the Atlantic in 5 days. So in the span of 5 sentences now, I've taken you from 2 months to 5 days to get across the Atlantic. You can imagine what that does in making these global expositions possible. If you want to go to Paris for a show and it takes 2 months to get there, very few people can do that. If it takes 5 days to get there, more people could probably put in for vacation time. We start to see that the challenge is speed and size. Every country wanted to have the biggest, fastest ship. And at a certain point, they maxed out. They couldn't make the hulls any bigger. They couldn't get across the ocean any faster. This is a great story about what happens when you reach the end of that competition. Germany announced the Imperator. It was going to be 900 feet long. And right after, France announced the Aquitania, which was going to be 901 feet long. They both were going to go about the same speed, so the only way they could win in the race to get customers and attention and press was to be the longest ship. So Hapag, the German company building the Imperator, stuck a 10-foot eagle on the front of the ship, making it 906 feet long, so it was once again the largest ship in the world. 6 days to cross the Atlantic, can't change that. We're going to look next week at what happens when you can't improve performance. You start instead to improve experience or style. And that's the story of ship design in the Art Deco period. So I offered a summary of what the Art Nouveau style looked like, and I offered a quick overview of how it might have spread so quickly. We need to look now at why it looked the way it did. And you may think I'm crazy for even having this chapter, but certainly for putting it first. I don't care. I think this is a really interesting flavor of the Art Nouveau period. There was an awareness of women's role in the world, in our society, in our daily lives, that was new and raw and complicated and made its way into not just what was happening politically and scientifically, but artistically. Women were fighting to get the vote, to have their voice in representation. I don't know if you're aware of this, but the first country to give women the vote was New Zealand, 1893. 2020, New Zealand's in the news for having their act together better than everyone else again. It really makes me wonder what's in the water in New Zealand, that they figure everything out before everybody else. Any rate, others followed soon thereafter, but some countries didn't follow so soon thereafter. Some are still not up to speed. At the time, in the Art Nouveau period, women were not only starting to talk about getting the vote and getting the vote, they were allowed into universities. Female doctors won the right to practice. Remember that in Britain, men didn't even have the vote till 1918. In 1914, only 2/5 of the men in England could vote, landowners only. World War I changed a lot of that. So it's amazing to me that women had to struggle and fight to get the vote. But it's also amazing how recent voting even is as a widespread activity. In Britain also, only women over 30 and still in qualified ways could vote in 1918. It took until 1928 for all women over the age of 21 to get the vote. Look at the different dates attached to when women were allowed to vote around the world. And these are just the ones I could easily identify. It's taken a really long time, but the conversation and the activity and the change started in the Art Nouveau period. The role of women was changing everywhere, and in France especially. So there was this focused attention on women and on female forms, which became a central decorative motif, especially in French Art Nouveau. You may think that's a crazy leap, like, women wanted the vote, and so we need naked ladies turned into butterflies. You may think this is a crazy connect the dot I'm doing here, but I really do believe that the anxiety about the role of women would have affected the objects that they were conceiving and producing and consuming. Here's an example, also at the RISD Museum, of a fireplace with two naked women carved right onto it. So if your wife goes off and becomes a doctor and leaves the house, at least you've got them, right? In 1884, J.K. Huysman wrote a book called Au Rebours, which means against nature. And there's a great quotation in it that every time I walk past this fireplace, I sort of think about. He wrote about the desire to envelop woman in a wholly depraved atmosphere, shaping furniture on the model of her charms, imitating her passionate contortions and spasmodic convulsions in the curves and convolutions of wood and copper. It's also possible that I wanted to talk about the changing role of women because I like to talk about Mariana Fortuny. And this is an even bigger stretch between the dots in my connect the dots game here. This is the last lecture I'm recording, and I kind of don't care. Deal with it. One of the reasons I like to talk about Mariana Fortuny is I really admire his work. The other is I really admire his path, and I think there's a lot that student designers can learn from examining how he got where he got. He started his life as a fine artist, a painter, and then he took up engraving. So all of the processes used for engraving were familiar to him, and he started to wonder if he couldn't print images on fabric using some of those processes. But that required bright light. He was using photographic processes and exposures to do this, and he didn't have access to light that was bright enough. Artificial light at the time was not very sophisticated. So being an enterprising and curious person, he decided he would solve that problem himself. Fortuny inverted the whole concept of what an electric light could be. He coated the outside of the bulb with a reflective surface to bounce the light back into the light fixture, which is a large diffusing dome. So all of the light is concentrated and focused and then shot outwards in a sort of even broadcast of light. And this produced more light, but more even light than any other light at the time had. That allowed him to do the work he wanted to do, but more interestingly, it also worked well as theater lighting, and he was interested in the mechanics of theaters. So he ended up licensing this design to the AEG, the German Electric Company, and they were installed in theaters all over Europe. Really successful design, not by someone who set out to be a lighting designer for theater, by someone who was trying to be a textile artist as an exploration of his fine art practice. Fortuny lamps are still made today in a number of different styles. The table lamp is relatively unchanged. The pedestal lamp, the floor lamp, has gone through a few variations of bases, but the basic concept is the same. You can buy the one on the right from Design Within Reach. Any design that lasts for 100 years has to be a good design. And he didn't stop there. He then realized, with his increased understanding of diffusing light and his ability to print patterns on fabric, he could combine those and make really beautiful sculptural fabric light fixtures. Remember in 1909, domestic electricity was so relatively new, and there wasn't a real consensus about what electric light fixtures were supposed to be. I think Fortuny did a really amazing job on a sort of first generation exploration to arrive at something really beautiful and also really enduring, because these are also still made today. Then he went back to the fabric that he was printing and started making tunics out of it, sort of a loose, unstructured garment that would best show off these incredible, rich, luxurious textile patterns. So the fabric panels were mostly rectangles so that he could show off his pattern as well as possible. The problem at the time was most women didn't have a way to wear a big rectangle tunic. So he created a dress to go underneath it, the Delphos dress, which is this pleated silk. And it really was created just to be a sort of quiet backdrop for these beautiful printed tunics. That ended up being the real game changer. I also should mention that Fortuny worked with his wife. She was his muse, but she also was his business partner. Her name was Henriette Negrin, and her story is not untold, but she's not well known. So if you're looking for where women are in design, if you're looking for husbands and wives who work together well, you should check them out a little bit more. And so here's what that dress unleashed. The woman on the left is wearing a tea dress for visiting in the daytime or for receiving friends at home in midday. So it's not a formal evening dress. It's more casual. And yet, look at this contraption. It's got layers and layers of fabric. It's got frills and frou-frou everywhere. She's corseted. Her shape is controlled. She is presented to the world as a manicured, controlled idea of what a woman's supposed to be. The woman on the right is sitting back, relaxed, confident, badass, don't mess with her. Completely different aspect, completely different presentation of what a woman could be in society. And the Fortuny dress became the sort of emblem of the liberated woman who didn't need a corset, who didn't need to be presentable. Also, the dress on the right is pleated, and you maintain the pleats by twisting it, and it wraps up into a little packet, fits in a little wooden box or in a little handbag. The dress on the left, you need a whole trunk to travel with. I should point out, the woman on the left is Olga de Meyer, who was the wife of Adolf de Meyer, famous photographer, and also his muse, probably the daughter of King Edward VII, and later in life a renowned lesbian, really interesting woman. The woman on the right is Selma Schubert, sister to Alfred Stieglitz. Also, the photograph on the right was taken by Stieglitz, and it's an early color photograph. It hasn't been hand-tinted. So Art Nouveau looked the way it did, I think, because of a changing idea about what women were going to be in our world. Number two would be an increased interest in nature as a contrast to what industrialization had done to our world. These are pictures of New York. That's Times Square, if you can believe it. We always had big ads there, just the material changed. And on the right is Glasgow. And you can see a lot of some things, that cheap paper printing, large-scale printing with color gave us advertising opportunities, so that's great. But what you can't see is evidence of nature. We forget that cities were industrial centers. As a result, people living in urban environments from the Victorian period all the way up through the Art Nouveau period were developing an ever less comfortable relationship with nature because there wasn't any left. The destruction of nature caused by urbanization and caused by the new wealth and the better farming and the moving into the cities from the country led to a focus on nature in art and design. People were seeking ways to balance what Freud called the nervous overstimulation caused by modern city life by looking to nature. So the Art Nouveau style is full of natural forms that were imagined to offer tranquility and beauty to counter what Freud called the embattled modern subconscious, and to provide a sort of escape from the urban landscape, which had been so decimated. I love the idea of, like, outside is ugly and industrial, but when I go home, everything is leaves and tendrils. Because so many people were moving to the cities, there was a population explosion. Vienna alone increased from under 500,000 in 1850 to over 2 million by 1910. With more people, you need more places for them to live, more buildings. More buildings need more furniture. And for the first time, because we had new steel and new elevators, we had new apartment buildings built in this new style for a whole new class of people with new money and outfitted with new furniture, new wallpaper, new fabrics, new objects. So many new things were being made to accommodate the moving of people and the changing of their economic status. Of course, they would be made in the most current style. So that's another reason this style could arrive so quickly and completely. The demand for decor exploded at the same time as an explosion in the ability to manufacture decor. We now could manufacture things in larger quantities. Even just the idea of decor and design as a profession was becoming mainstream at this time. I don't know how many of my students read Candace Wheeler this week. I hope all of them, because I find that every time I reread Candace Wheeler's writing, I find more about it to enjoy. She was one of the first professional interior designers working in America. One of my favorite quotations of hers is, "Small things cease to be unimportant if largely treated." That's good. So nature was everywhere. It was in apartment buildings, it was in decor, it was in fennel-shaped teapots. You could look at these art glass lamps from Nancy in France and wonder why anybody was making mushrooms and dandelions into lighting fixtures. Or you could realize that nature plus glass techniques plus electricity was a new equation. No one knew what a table lamp should look like, so why not have it be a mushroom or a dandelion and bring nature in? You turn the light on and you illuminate nature in your gloomy, sad life. This doesn't really belong in an industrial design history class because the art glass made in Nancy in the Art Nouveau period was handmade. This is a craft enterprise. Although they did serialize production, they rationalized their workers, so work went down the production line and different skills were applied at different times. But I'm not allowed to talk about the Art Nouveau period without showing you some Art Nouveau art glass. Another thing to think about is that between 1850 and 1900, large quantities of Roman glass were discovered, dug up. And people fell in love with the iridescent surfaces and the colors, and the production techniques were lost. So one of the things that the Art Nouveau glass artists were trying to do was replicate those colors and textures and techniques. And here's two things made by Dom, because if I don't show all three of the great glassmakers in Nancy, someone's gonna come and get me. You understand why these things fit in the Art Nouveau in their celebration of nature. They just don't necessarily fit in industrialization, but whatever. This whole lecture is full of whatevers. Okay, my next reason, the slide tells me, is Japan. So we've got women's role in society, an appreciation of nature, and Japan. Before Admiral Perry's expedition in 1853, Japan only traded with the Dutch and the Chinese in a really restricted way since 1639. So for 200 plus years, Japan was relatively closed off from the outside world and kept most of their ancient traditions alive and didn't adopt the ways of other cultures. It was a really isolated, kind of wonderful maturing that happened. And Admiral Perry ruined that. He arrived with his ship, which was a big steam-powered, smoke-belching paddle-wheel monster, in the harbor of Japan in 1853, and said, "I'm coming back in 9 months with some friends who have ships just like this, and you're going to trade with us." And Japan said, "Well, we don't want to do that." So he arrived 9 months later with a whole fleet of these horrible, steam-powered, smoke-belching, paddle-wheeled monsters, and began trade with Japan. So the good news for the rest of the world is we got to fall in love with everything Japanese, which we had never seen before. The bad news for the Japanese was they had no choice in this. And I love this slide because on the top we see photography, the triumph of the West, showing us what things looked like. We know that Admiral Perry looked like that, and we know that his ship looked like that. On the bottom are Japanese-produced images of Admiral Perry and his ship, and I think they are so much more powerful because they're not just saying, "Here's what he looked like." They're saying, "Here's what it felt like to meet him. Here's what it felt like to see that ship." There's a whole extra layer of emotion built into those images. Very quickly, Japan was forced to take on the role of exporter to the rest of the world, and they took that role on really successfully. In 1862, at the International Exhibition in London, there were Japanese exhibits. And from that show on, every global exposition had a Japanese pavilion selling and promoting Japanese wares. How people find out about design and new design things happens a bunch of ways. Sometimes through education, at schools, at a lecture. Sometimes education happens through communal gatherings like global expositions. Sometimes it also just happens because there's a person who's determined to spread the word. Siegfried Bing is a great example of that with the Art Nouveau. He opened his gallery in 1890 in Paris, and you can see there it's called L'Art Nouveau. You go and buy Art Nouveau stuff at his gallery. When I say this period proclaimed its own existence and name, this is a great example. He fell in love with Japanese prints, and in 1893, he organized an exhibition of Japanese woodblock prints that he showed in Paris, that he sent to travel in Britain and in New York, and thousands of people saw Japanese woodblock prints for the first time. He was a significant voice in the preaching of the gospel of Japanese art and design. In 1895, his gallery was redone with new Art Nouveau interiors created by Henri Vandevelde, a well-known Belgian Art Nouveau designer whom we'll see again in a kind of unlikely way in a few weeks. I'm hoping my students all watched a short video about Christopher Dresser right before this one, so I don't need to talk about him now, but this is where he fits in this story as well. His travels in Japan for 4 months, his exporting of thousands of objects from Japan, and then his own work incorporating the Japanese aesthetic into his manufactured items is a big part of this story as well. Where he fits in here is the objects he acquired for Tiffany to use as a design library for all of the things they made in the Japanese style. Because at this point, all scales of things in all materials were being influenced by Japanese art. Silver, ceramic, glass, anything. Every manufacturer in the West began looking to the East for inspiration. And you can find literal Japanese motifs, almost like they've just been rubber stamped onto things, plucked off of something authentic and stuck onto whatever we were making, and you could find looser interpretations. And we started to produce things that are very reminiscent of what was happening with ceramics in the late 1700s. We were taking Western forms and slapping Eastern motifs on them in these crazy mashups. I need to expand this though, because it's not really that the Art Nouveau style happened because people were interested in Japan. It's a big part of what made up the style. But there's a larger kind of umbrella category going on here. So we've got an appreciation of women, an appreciation of nature, an appreciation of Japan. But if I expand that, we were starting to be interested in other cultural aesthetics, not just Japan, lots of them. And sadly, all of it involves colonialism. So even Japan, we opened up by force. We saw that all of the industrialized nations were colonizing all the non-industrialized ones, because they were easy to take over through military action and rich in resources, for labor, for materials. So every major industrialized country went on a hunt for some piece of land or some group of people that hadn't been claimed yet. France had colonies in Tunisia, Africa, and Asia. Britain had colonies everywhere, but added Egypt to that. Italy took over Libya. Holland had colonies in Indonesia. Belgium took over the Congo. Germany took over much of Africa. And I'm going to argue that the U.S. took over its own West. Our westward expansion and the taking over of all the Native American land and forcing the Native Americans out is just as ugly a colonization as any of the others. And that really affected art and design, partly because we were coming in contact with other cultures that had other aesthetics, partly because there were new materials coming into manufacturing. The King of Belgium, in an effort to stimulate trade with the Belgian Congo, offered free material to artists, tusks and rare materials, to help them make those materials fashionable. So there's some crazy Belgian jewelry at the time, full of opals and carved ivory, that pretty much exists just to get people interested in more trade with the colony and make that relationship stronger. And throughout the Art Nouveau period, you can see this quest for the exotic developing. Tiffany alone made things in styles called Moorish and Pompeian and Saracenic, which is Syrian. In addition to colonies, we were starting to look at history. Pompeii had been discovered in the 1600s, but by the 1870s, it was finally cataloged and proper scientific excavation began. So archaeology had already been around for a long time, but in the 1880s and 90s, it started to be not only a profession, but a sort of a science, a more careful activity. And as a result, there was a real craze for some of the things we were discovering, some of the ancient cultures. All of this information, the rare materials, the foreign cultures, the new aesthetics, the people we were colonizing, the people we were rediscovering from history, wove together as companies made these big show-stopping pieces for global expos. So many of the biggest, fanciest, most remarkable things made at the time are also sort of now the most embarrassing and problematic ones. Our museums are full of astounding examples of craftsmanship that we might find ourselves scratching our heads over now. Sometimes artists and designers took on the challenge of looking at other cultures with some kind of sensitivity. The Viking Punch Bowl was exhibited by Tiffany at the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition in 1893. And I think it shows a fascination with civilizations of the past. It's using decarbonized iron inlaid with silver and gold and has this beautiful calamander wood base. And it's using materials and craftsmanship to elevate the memory of the Vikings in a way. This is easier to do because the Vikings didn't exist at this point. But I'm holding this up as an example of an artistic exploration of some foreign culture or foreign aesthetic that I think is well executed in a way that honors it. And I'd like to compare it to something that doesn't. Because sometimes artists and designers did things that were not sensitive. This is a piece by Joseph Heinrichs and sold by Shreve Crump and Lowe. I believe it now lives in Baltimore. And it's hardly honoring Native American culture or Native Americans. It's just copying a bunch of motifs and sticking them on a punch bowl and sticking Native Americans right on that punch bowl. So this is the second thing I'm going to show you this semester that I think tips into being product racism. In this case, really blatantly so. It's so hard to look back on these things from where we are now and be forgiving about them. But at the time, this was a perfectly acceptable enterprise. And there are lots of examples of this kind of thing. In fact, we don't know that Joseph Heinrichs designed this, but it's so like everything else he did that it's likely. He made scores of objects with other cultures on them, and he specialized in combining silver and copper. And I'm going to go off-roading again, because there's another designer I want to talk about who probably doesn't belong here and you probably don't care about, but I think there's something to be learned from what he did. Paulding Farnham worked at Tiffany from 1885 on and was design director there from 1891 to 1908. His first real claim to fame was the orchid pins he made that won every award they could at the global expositions they were shown at. He figured out a way to enamel on gold that was so close to the actual orchid that these were unbelievably realistic. He produced jewelry in a wide range of styles, but I'm most interested in his metalwork. Farnham designed the big showstopper pieces that went on view at the expositions Tiffany was participating in. And remember, the goal of these pieces is to show off the wealth of the country they come from. This is a silver vase that Tiffany made that's mimicking a Pueblo pattern, a Native American pattern. So it's showing the material wealth of the country with the silver and the rubies. It's showing the craftsmanship wealth of the country with the inlay work and the enamel. And it's also showing the cultural wealth of our country by taking Pueblo art to Paris. I'm not saying this isn't offensive to someone. It probably is. This is the problem with appropriation. You may think it's fine. Someone else may not. So the best thing you can do if you're looking for a way to not create problems is to either not borrow other people's motifs or involve them, ask them, find out. But we're talking about history here. This is 1893, whole different era. When I look at this object, it seems to me that it's honoring its source materials, both the actual material it's made of and the aesthetic content that it has borrowed. Paulding also designed this vase on the left, which used to be called the Pueblo vase, but it isn't anymore, and I think that's because it isn't modeled on a Pueblo motif. I think it's a hoopa basket. At any rate, it's a Native American form, very literally translated. But it's also an incredibly complicated technique of inlaying silver and copper together in this geometric pattern. And it has snake handles with turquoise from Arizona. So again, it's a mashup of the materials we had, the cultural wealth that we had, and the craftsmanship that Tiffany was going to put on view. I want to tell you a little bit about the history of Tiffany because I think in your head it's probably a monolith. It's just that store in New York that sells jewelry. It has a really long, interesting history, and because Tiffany keeps entering my conversations in this class, I feel like you should know that it has multiple eras. Charles Tiffany founded the company in 1837, but he was just a merchant, a stationer in downtown New York, and he slowly built the business. At first, he sold silver that he bought from someone else, then he started having silver made, then they started making the silver in-house. So Tiffany slowly migrated from just a wholesale stationer to an early example of American manufacturing prowess in tableware and silver and also jewelry. His design director in 1877 was Edward C. Moore, who's the person who received all of the stuff from Japan from Christopher Dresser. Charles's son was Lewis Comfort Tiffany, who took over the company in 1902. He's someone you'll hear about in a bunch of different ways. Lewis Comfort Tiffany developed something he called Fevrille glass, and he wanted to give production glass the same luster and beauty of ancient Roman glass. And this is kind of funny to me because ancient Roman glass was originally clear, but then it spent so long buried in the ground, decomposing and absorbing minerals, that it became iridescent and colored. So he wasn't actually copying ancient Roman glass, but whatever, it's beautiful. He trademarked and patented the techniques involved in producing this in 1894. In 1879, he formed Associated Artists with Candace Wheeler. You can go to the Armory in New York and still see some of their interiors. Also the Mark Twain House in Hartford, Connecticut. In 1892, he started Tiffany Glass and Decorating Company to do stained glass. Siegfried Bing, Mr. Art Nouveau in Paris, came to America in 1894 and visited Tiffany's factory, and they signed a deal for Siegfried Bing to be the sole distributor of Tiffany's glass in Europe. So Tiffany's footprint in Paris filtered right through the sort of portal of Art Nouveau. In 1900, he started Tiffany Studios. And in 1902, when he took over his father's business, he merged all of those companies and really took over Tiffany's. You're familiar with his work? Well, I don't know. People used to all be familiar with his work because we had this thing called television. And on this thing called television, there was a program called Antiques Roadshow. And every person who went on Antiques Roadshow brought any old scrap of stained glass that they were hoping would turn out to be a long-lost Lewis Comfort Tiffany treasure worth millions. Sometimes they were. And I think they fit right into that Art Nouveau exploration of what happens when you take glass and electricity and nature and combine them. You get a table lamp that mimics a natural form. So this is the American Art Nouveau version of the dandelion or mushroom lamp that I showed you from France. And that leads me to reason number four. So we have appreciation of women, of nature, of the exotic. And number four reason why the Art Nouveau looked the way it did is science. There was a new vocabulary of organic forms. This is the work of Ernst Haeckel, a German botanist, scientist, crackpot. He had a microscope and he started looking at microorganisms under the water and he recorded them. Imagine you lived in a world where you had never seen these images and then someone put them in front of you, especially if you're an artist or designer. It would completely change your opportunities. And that was happening all over the place. Microscopes allowed the study of things at a whole new scale. So it allowed science to happen, but it also allowed a new kind of art and design to happen. New technology, like better microscopes and better ability to grind glass, was a big part of the advance of science. But all of those processes could be repurposed for the advance of art and design as well. In 1889, we figured out how to silver electrodeposit onto glass. So I already talked about silver plating, which is electrodepositing silver onto another metal, onto brass or nickel. You run an electric current through an object in a bath, and then a silver ingot is oppositely charged, so the silver particles swim through the liquid and stick onto the metal. I don't know if I described that right, but I think I did. We then figured out how we could do that on glass by laying a coat of metal on first and etching that off, or by painting a copper layer on with a brush. So this is inherently hand done. It has to be painted on by brush. And that leads to a sort of flowing surface form. And you get this wonderful layering where blown glass is sort of surrounded by a cage of sterling silver. In addition to new scientific processes, we had a flourishing of the chemical industries. Better science, better chemistry. Better chemistry, more chemicals. More chemicals, more options. You could buy acid as a paste, so you could use acid to etch surfaces and create patterns that way. Again, this would be hand-painted, so you get sort of flowing forms. You also could buy a grinding wheel and put it on your electric motor. So you could say that these Emile Gallet glass pieces are these shapes and these patterns because that was his aesthetic. Or you could also go out on a limb and say, if you took a glass vessel and a spinning grinding wheel and rammed them together, you're likely to get a bunch of wave shapes. Part of this science chapter also relates to education. Before art and design schools, botany and biology and science were kind of the best education for someone inclined towards a career in art and design. And we saw that with Christopher Dresser, who was trained as a botanist. As a result, any of the artists who were trained in nature or botany were inclined towards the organic forms that are so popular in the Art Nouveau period. With the advent of proper art and design schools, including RISD, 1877, there was a whole new generation of artists trained specifically as designers and as designers for industry, which was a whole new field. If I expand that idea that science affected the aesthetic of the Art Nouveau movement, I want to point out that there's other sciences at play here too. If we're looking at new scales of things with microscopes, there are things underwater I couldn't see. Of course, people also started looking at other places where they couldn't see with their eyes, but there might be some presence. There was a huge boom in spirituality, in the belief in the afterlife. There also was the rise of psychoanalysis at the end of the 19th century, an interest in dreams and the unconscious. Freud published The Interpretation of Dreams in 1900 and The Theory of Sexuality in 1905. Imagine what that did to the world. So you could look at this water pitcher that's a coiled up snake and say it's a snake just to be fun. And the thing on the right, I don't even know what it's trying to be, but it's clearly some underwater reference. Is it a sleeping octopus? I don't know. These are not objects that are trying to be pretty. They're not a pitcher covered in chrysanthemums. These are objects trying to elicit some other kind of emotional response. I think these are dreamlike objects being made at a time when dreams were starting to become part of scientific exploration. So I think my last reason in this category, appreciation of women, nature, the exotic, increased presence of science, and immersion, being completely surrounded by the Art Nouveau style. One example is the Paris subway. Hector Guimard made the technology of the Paris Metro and the style he introduced into an immersive experience for everyone visiting the 1900 Paris Expo. This could have gone before when I talked about the Expo, but for me it fits better here. They realized that not only did they need moving sidewalks to move people around the fair, they needed a way for people to get to the fair. People were coming from all over and would need to travel. So the entire metro system was installed, and there were competitions to figure out what the architecture above would be. And just like with the 1851 Crystal Palace Exposition, the architects were proposing raising a whole block, clearing all the buildings to build a train station, doing massive, invasive structures above ground. And Guimard realized you didn't need anything above ground. All you needed was a little bit of protection from the weather and something that served as a beacon. This is where you enter. The metro is underground. It doesn't need a huge representative above ground. It just needs something to indicate the entry point. And he designed a series of structures that were cast iron, parts made off-site and brought in, and panels of glass. So this is not unlike the Crystal Palace from 1851. So although everything he designed is fully Art Nouveau and has nothing to do with a Crystal Palace aesthetically, it's the same solution. It's prefabricating lightweight parts offsite that can be assembled quickly. It's the smallest amount of invasion you can do into a city block and still have something that works as a metro station. Many of them are still there today. Anyone who's been to Paris, I'm sure, has been through one or seen one or had their picture taken in front of one. They've held up really well. The next part of this immersion story gets me back to talking about commerce. The department store arrived and matured in the Art Nouveau period. The first was Le Bon Marché in Paris in 1869. And it was the first place where commerce was centralized. Instead of going to all different vendors, people could go to one place and have all the things they needed in one building. And that introduced consumers to the delights of convenience, buying everything they needed in one place. But even more than that, the delights of discovering things they didn't know they needed, finding things they just wanted and couldn't live without. That approach to consumerism, which fuels our whole world today, started with the department store in the Art Nouveau period. It also spread the gospel of the Art Nouveau style because the buildings, these huge immersive spaces, were all built new. There was no pre-existing sort of building type for a department store, so they were mostly built in the Art Nouveau style. In 1912, Gallery Lafayette was redesigned with a completely new Art Nouveau staircase and a main hall. So all of the big department stores that we know in our world today came to life in the Art Nouveau period. European department stores really promoted the Art Nouveau style through their architecture. In American department stores, the significance of retail was less about style and more about sorting out the commerce. If you're interested in commerce, you should read about John Wanamaker in Philadelphia. His first store opened in 1861, and he relocated in 1876 to a vacant railroad freight depot. No one knew what a department store was supposed to be, so it might as well be an abandoned train station. And it had concentric rings of tables with sales clerks behind each table. In 1896, he opened a new 16-story building in New York, a massive, massive retail hub. At the time, it was the largest space in the world devoted to selling things. In Philadelphia in 1903, he built a 12-story granite store complete with a 150-foot-high central hallway, a central gallery, and the second largest organ in the world. Where do organs normally live? Not in stores, right? They live in cathedrals, churches. So Wanamaker, even though he was a pious man, was making a bold statement that the new god was commerce, that you would come to the department store for your worship service.
I usually start the Art Nouveau lecture with information about Christopher Dresser. Although he lived chronologically in the Victorian era, his work predicted what was happening in the Art Nouveau period in his interest in incorporating Japanese information in his design work, in his ability to embrace manufacturing to arrive at new kinds of forms instead of mimicking older ones. And I'm going to end the Art Nouveau conversation with information about Peter Behrens. They're sort of open and closed brackets, because Behrens lived chronologically in the Art Nouveau era, but his work predicts what happened after. So I don't know where you want to put them in the flow of the history of design, but they go somewhere. Usually when new technologies enter our world, they're not designed, they're merely created, invented, engineered, and then design slowly takes over to consider the user and manufacturing and aesthetics. Behrens had a genius for introducing first-generation new technologies that were fully mature. So I think there's a lot to learn by examining how he did that. Last week, we looked at a bunch of really ugly new technologies. They worked well, they improved our lives, but they didn't really arrive at a designed version of themselves very quickly. Here's another great example, the electric washing machine. When we got small electric motors, we could attach them to things and remove the manual labor from those processes. But we didn't tend to take the next step and care what those objects looked like. We were so excited that the manual labor was gone. And it's a difficult challenge as a designer to take on a new technology, because if you make it look too new, no one will know what it does. It will be too alien. If you make it reference the older version that it's replacing, nobody will understand that it's a new thing. So how you balance looking forward and backwards and straddle that in the middle with confidence is a real challenge. Behrens did this with an amazing kind of confidence. These electric devices are from the exact same time period as those washing machines. And you can see the difference, right? From 1907 to 1914, Peter Behrens was hired as a freelance artistic consultant for the AEG, the German electric company. This is the first time a major company did that, embraced design by bringing in a freelance designer and letting them have access to everything, redesigning everything the company was producing. Electric companies at the time were struggling to figure out how to monetize electricity. We were mostly just using it for light bulbs. So by getting people using electricity in their homes more, they could sell more electricity. The challenge for the AEG became producing electrified versions of existing products, partly to improve the customer experience, but mostly to sell electricity. The kettle on the bottom is one of Behrens' great triumphs because it's clear to everyone that it's a kettle.
just like the one that sits on your stove. But there's just enough different about it that we understand it's a new kind of kettle. And he did that with aesthetics. So the technology is new, but that's not the part we see. We see the aesthetics of this kettle as something forward-looking, but the form of it as something backwards-looking. How to balance the components to get that all to work correctly is a real struggle for designers, even today. Graphic designers think of Behrens as a graphic designer because he took over the identity of the AEG. In fact, the whole idea of identity design is something that Behrens introduced. So in addition to doing product design for them, he redesigned their logos, their advertising, their catalogs, their exhibitions, and their showrooms, rethinking all the identity tools that made that public statement about what the AEG was. Architects think of Behrens as an architect because he also designed buildings for the company. This turbine hall has a huge expanse for big pieces of equipment with no columns in the middle. And the engineering involved in making that happen is allowed to show in the form of the building. And that relationship between new kind of building and new kind of aesthetic is the same thing that's on view in the kettles, but here scaled way up for architecture. He also fits in the world of architecture because of the shadow his practice cast on the profession. People who worked in his office included Walter Gropius, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Le Corbusier, and Adolf Meyer. He designed all of the showrooms for the AEG also, but for me, the best part of what Peter Behrens did, forget the graphic design, forget the architecture, it's the stuff that lived in those showrooms. If you remember the American system of manufacturing, where we struggled to make repeat, replaceable, interchangeable parts, so you could make all the parts first and assemble them into something after, this is that, but with an added layer of smart, because he realized if he standardized the connection points, he could interchange the parts from one model to another and use a small kit of parts to make a large body of lamps, of kettles, of things. So standardization, not just of the manufacturing process, but kind of the design and assembly process as well. As a result, you start to see a family resemblance between all the products because they're sharing so many parts. A good example of this is the kettles. They came in three sizes, they had three finishes, there were three different metals and three different shapes, which produced 30 different models of kettle. Something else Behrens did that you should know about is with Bruno Paul, Joseph Maria Albrecht, and Joseph Hoffmann, found the Deutsche Werkbund. This was an organization in Germany that was trying to sort of be a matchmaker between designers and industry. Industry was figuring out how to make things. Designers were figuring out what things could look like and how they could work better, but they weren't really working together as well as they needed to. And Behrens realized there was an opportunity to intentionally advance design as a profession by getting in there and linking up designers with businesses. After World War I, there was a widespread need for products, and this led to an embracing of standardization and industrial production that had been resisted before the war. So the Deutsche Werkbund was perfectly positioned to really help solve some problems. In 1908, the Werkbund had 500 members, including 12 different companies. But by 1914, there were 2,000 members. The Werkbund also led directly to the post-war 1919 Bauhaus, so you'll be hearing about it again. The Art Nouveau style ended really suddenly, gone, because of World War I. There were 8.5 million people dead, 21 million people wounded. That's nearly 2% of the entire global population. So nothing after the war could exist without calling attention to those statistics, to those numbers. The only real way you can move on after some major catastrophe is to move on completely. You have to sort of say, like, the people who made that war are gone. We who survived it are not those people. We're different people, we're new people, we're better people, and we're going to make different and new and better things and have different and better new ideas and thoughts and laws. So any style that existed before the war has to also go. Any war, especially World War I, requires huge mechanical and social and political machinery to launch and support the war effort. And after the war, all of this potential needs to be reapplied to peacetime living. That's where designers come in. There are all these new things we know how to do. They need to be applied to our daily lives. And as a result, in this period,
all of the ideas about mechanization and industry and actual mass production that were sort of developing and being toyed with before the war matured and became everyday realities in the years after the war. So there'd be no reason to go back to a style like the Art Nouveau, which was trying to stylistically predict a modern new thing, but didn't really have technology figured out, when you could instead go to a new style that fully embraced those new manufacturing techniques and new thinkings about what stuff should be. In the next big era, the Art Deco period, which by the way was named in the 1960s, when it was happening, no one knew what it was called, unlike the Art Nouveau, designers began to harness and tame all of the novelties and new ways of thinking that developed in the Art Nouveau period and produce items not only with a startling new kind of modern aesthetic, but in larger quantities. The shift from the Victorian aesthetic to the Art Nouveau aesthetic was dramatic and fast, but the shift from Art Nouveau to Art Deco was even more dramatic and even faster. And I think you'll see a lot of our world today in what was being designed in the Art Deco period, because most of the ways of thinking about how to design from the machine were really developed in that period and are still with us today. Okay, see you next time. Okay, remember at the beginning I said stick around? Here's my message. Last spring, in March, two of my students who came from India were really upset that they had to leave immediately to get back before the borders closed. And in an effort to give them a sense of normalcy, like not everything is stopping, I promised to record the lectures and share them with them. I didn't ever imagine that 2 days later everybody would leave and I'd have to record all the lectures and share them. So the Art Deco lecture, although it's the fifth lecture in this sequence, it was actually the first one that I recorded. You're gonna see that. There's pretty clear evidence that I thought I was recording it for two people and not spending all that long being careful about how I did it. I just wanted to explain that because all of the fancy techniques I've invented for these later ones, like the $9 green screen and the clip-on lights and a microphone, aren't gonna be there. So you may wonder why the sudden huge step backwards in production quality. It's not like any of these have been well made. They're all just made with spit and a prayer, but I thought that was worth saying. And I also want to thank those students, because if I hadn't started doing this as a personal favor for two people I liked who were in distress, I never would have started doing it. It was a massive undertaking that sort of exposed all the flaws in my research, in my images, in my kit. And putting those out there is a kind of humbling experience. And in the end, it was also a great experience. So, see you next time. I have to take a break to push my glasses up. See, I know you've caught me pushing my glasses up all semester. It's not that I mean, they're cheap glasses, but they're designed to go there because they're reading glasses. But now I'm recording and they have to go way up there where they don't fit. So don't blame me.
What's that? Did I get bit by something? Splinter. It's a splinter. When did I get a splinter? I've just been sitting in front of my computer all day, every day. I have a computer splinter. Haha, I got bit. It's a bite.
Okay. Also, by 1870, the screw propeller was in regular use. I have trouble saying screw propeller. Screw propeller. Screw propeller. Screw propeller. By 1870, the screw propeller... I can't say it. By 1800, screw propellers, propeller. Because so many people were moving to the city, there is a bug in here and I'm going to get it. Did I get it? Graphic designer. He features large... Oh, God. I'm going to have to start the whole thing over because of the sun coming in. Where's that sun coming in from? Hi, it's me. I'm really sorry to interrupt. The thing is, I'm editing this video, and I've just discovered that my camera turned itself off. I have the audio, so I can finish the lecture, but I won't be standing there in front of everything, and I know how important that is to you. The thing is, I could go upstairs and find those clothes and set up the $9 piece of nylon green screen and turn the clip lights on again and restart the 10-year-old camera that apparently isn't up to this task.
and re-record it and stick it in, and maybe you'd never notice. I just can't. I can't. I think that would be the straw that breaks this camel's back.